Okay, this is our 18th class. We'll be covering pages 242 through 256. And as you've noticed, the last couple of books, when you're set to read the Bible in a year and a half, it takes a serious commitment. And so the last couple of books, in two bites, we get through a whole book. That's a lot of reading. We had 11 chapters last week. We're going to have some 13 tonight in the book of Joshua. So with just the briefest of reviews, what we saw last week in Joshua chapter 1 is Moses, God, through Moses, telling Joshua that he must be strong and courageous as he has much work to be doing. In chapter 2, then, he crosses the Jordan, reestablishes the sign of the covenant in circumcision, which had been neglected while they were in the wilderness, there in chapters 3, 4, and 5. And then the battle, the work, begins. Chapter 6, 7, and 8, we have the wondrous tale and the great success of the conquest of Jericho, and then the terrible failure and the distress of seeing that a single soul whose sins can impact even to the death of a significant number of people because of their sin, the consequences are far-ranging. This is not because God is cruel. This is not because he's vindictive. It's not because God relishes punishing people or something like that. It's simply that we are learning the nature of the world that we live in, the way things work. Sin is not an isolated thing unto yourself. It involves other people. So constantly throughout Scripture, we've touched on it several times before, we learn to avoid sin, do the best that we can, keep ourselves pure, if not for our own sake, if not for God's sake, then for the sake of those that we love, those that are a part of our families and of our communities. So after the defeat at Ai, of course, they do, in a second attempt, conquer the city of Ai, and then are deceived by the Gibeonites, make a treaty with the Gibeonites, and in chapter 10, we'll find themselves defending the Gibeonites, which is a terrible irony, that a people who should have been put to death are now the hewers of wood and carriers of water, but because they've made a covenant with them without thinking about it very well or consulting God, they therefore are now forced to lose soldiers of their own in the defense of a people that they should certainly not be defending. The sun stands still in one particular battle. And then in chapter 10, the first conquests of Canaan now, in a sort of a loop that heads mostly to the south, takes place before we come to chapter 11, where they turn their thoughts and attention then to the northern reaches of Israel. So in a matter of just a very few chapters, the army has been exceptionally busy. They have had some successes and some failures. They have learned some lessons, to say the least, through Achan's sin, but largely are succeeding. So, if you remember the map from last week, they have come along the eastern shores of the Dead Sea and through the mountains there, fighting their way up two battles on that side. Before they came to Mount Nebo, Moses viewed the land. They descended the mountains to the plains of Moab. Apparently, were using Gilgal then as a sort of a camp and a base from which they attacked Jericho, and then Ai made the traverse northward up to Shechem. Apparently, taking the people there immediately again to renew the covenant. Some of the people on one mountain, some on the other of Gabel and or Ebal rather, and Gerizim, and reciting then the blessings and the curses. After which, again apparently using Gilgal as their base, they then head to the west before guiding to the south, down into finally what will be the area of Simeon, as we're reading about tribal lands here in this week's reading. So, initially, they've just made kind of a circle here. They started off on this side of the Dead Sea, now they're in the Promised Land on the other side, and in that region of Judah and Simeon, future tribal lands, that great success. Then, in the north, they head up along the Jordan River, stay on the west side of the Sea of Galilee, come on actually very far north, attacking each of these various people. You see Phoenicia being the region generally of the Phoenicians, and all the way up into Tyre, driving them even beyond before returning, taking the city of Hazor, which, by the way, is just a marvelous archaeological site to this day, and then running up again now further to the east, but up to the very headwaters, or the spring, of the Jordan River there at Dan. So from the south and to the north, having entered right in the middle, they have been very successful in driving these people out, save for the Gibeonites. Now, what we'll be looking at tonight, chapters 12 through 24, 13 through 19 is seven chapters on tribal allotments. Thrilling reading, wasn't it? Okay. I hope you all did that one out loud, just for the laughs. Okay. All those cities, names that drive you crazy, you know, and we don't even know for sure how to pronounce them today after all these years gone by, and then all these geographical locations there just, you know, drive you nuts. Now, I remember in last week's reading, in the introductory material, they pointed out that Joshua is the single most geographical book that you have in the entire Bible. For the Jews of the time, profoundly important. It's everything to them, and it needs to be recorded because this is the deed to the land. This is the description, formally, of each tribal area, and the cities, of course, of refuge will be associated with them later in the book. There are 20, in chapter 20, excuse me, there are the cities of refuge listed for us. In chapter 21, we are then told which cities that the Levites will have. And again, I'm not going to spend, you know, a whole lot of time on that here tonight. They are cities of refuge. Somebody tell me, what's a city of refuge?
Place where the
manslayer can go. An accidental homicide makes you a manslayer, didn't intend to do it. Then there is what is called the Avenger of Blood. And in that system at the time, if you accidentally killed somebody, the family members were allowed to hunt you down and put you to death. God had an extremely high premium on human life, which we do not any longer today. It's just terrible that we don't have the respect for human life that we ought in the culture in which we're living, and of course, throughout the world. At that time, God had made it abundantly plain, you shed man's blood, then by man your blood shall be shed. And even if it was accidental, satisfying apparently the family's needs, then their avenger of blood could track you down, unless you could get to a city of refuge. Once you got to the city of refuge, were you just home free? You win? Get out of jail free? No, you're still subject to a trial, and the evidence is going to be adduced, and if you have been lying about it, then now you're guilty of murder rather than an accidental slaying. What would happen to you? You'd be put to death, as you must be to show respect for human life. We don't do this anymore, hardly ever at least, you know, in our country, and it's a shame, and it's a frightening thing. God still has the same respect. Now, as a nation, we don't seem to, and so it's worrisome. You know, our time will come like any other nation. So the cities of refuge in chapter 20. Chapter 21, the Levites did not have a what? What were they not given? Okay, an actual tribal land. Okay. Did they have land? Well, they had land in designated cities and up to a certain area, and I forget, I don't believe it was in the reading here, and I'm not sure if it comes up in another time, but within a certain distance of each of these cities, the Levites then encircled the city and could own land there for their flocks and for their herds. And so they were not a bunch of paupers. They weren't a bunch of monks. They were able to make a living as well as being supported in their work with first the tabernacle and later the temple. So they had provisions and activities in these various cities. But again, the Levitical system is gone. We're not familiar with, you know, the whole system there. And so I really don't want to spend a bunch of time on that. But what we're going to do is go to chapter 22 now, as I suggested. We'll look at the last couple of chapters, and then we'll come back and look at these tribal allotments. I'd rather put them at the end in case I run out of time here, you know, and we can go a little faster with that latter material. So everybody, chapter 22. In chapter 22, we're going to be on page 252, and in the right-hand column, if you have the Chronological Study Bible itself, they're about the middle of the column, in verse 11. So you're breaking into the paragraph there, but at verse 11, the children of Israel heard someone say, "Behold, the children of Reuben, the children of Gad, and half the tribe of Manasseh have built an altar on the frontier of the land of Canaan, in the region of the Jordan, on the children of Israel's side. And when the children of Israel heard of it, the whole congregation of the children of Israel gathered together at Shiloh to go to war against them." So all that happened was they heard that these three tribal groups, two full tribes and one that's half a tribe, split in half, and half a tribe, going to have its land on the eastern side of the Jordan. They had gone and built an altar. Which side of the Jordan did they build it on? The east side that they lived on, or the west side that they didn't live on? They built it on the west side. That west side was not within their tribal land, but that is the border. So if anybody was going to be coming that way into that region, what would they see last thing before you leave the main body of the Holy Land, as it's so often called, but that land flowing with milk and honey, that promised land? You'd see this altar, and you'd have to pass it in order to go into these three tribal areas there. Now, immediately they built this altar, the report comes back, and they think it over very carefully and deliberately, and what conclusion do they reach? Kill them all! Well, that's kind of overreacting, isn't it? But I think not, and it's extremely interesting to me, at least, what is revealed in just a few verses now on page 253, continuing in the 22nd chapter, but skipping down now to verse 18. In verse 18 and a half, the second half of verse 18, right at the top, the fourth line down, "It shall be, if you rebel today against the Lord, that tomorrow he'll be angry with what? The whole congregation of Israel. Nevertheless, if the land of your possession is unclean," so you don't like it, "then cross over to the land of the possession of the Lord, where the Lord's tabernacle stands. Take possession among us, but do not rebel against the Lord, nor rebel against us, by building yourselves an altar besides the altar of the Lord our God. Did not Achan the son of Zerah commit a trespass in the accursed thing? And wrath fell on all the congregation of Israel, and that man did not perish alone in his iniquity." Did anybody else participate consciously in Achan's iniquity? No. For all we know, his wife didn't know he had done that. He had taken these things that were under the ban that he was not supposed to take from Jericho, and then he hid them underneath the floor of the tent. As far as we know, he's the only guy that knew anything about it. But who paid the price? See, all of Israel. Even secret sins that an individual commits have wide-ranging consequences. Today, we would recoil in horror and say, well, that's just unfair. That's because we don't understand what fair is. We particularly do not understand what righteousness is and what it is to be a part of a group that is dedicated to God. So if the Old Testament uses types and figures and shadows, three terms that are used in Scripture, so that we can learn lessons as Christians today, what's the lesson here? We're in it together. Okay? Your behavior and activities reflect on everybody. And that is true positively as well as negatively. Did they learn their lesson? Oh, they learned their lesson in Achan and in Ai. So, as soon as they find out that it looks like somebody's getting ready to forsake God, what do they immediately do? Declare war. Okay? They got it. Now, if that's their response, how truly motivated do you think these people were at this time, just entered into their promised land, to be faithful and righteous and holy and serve their God with all their hearts, with all their soul, with all their minds, and their neighbor as themselves, which Leviticus had already told us, chapter 19. They're serious about it, aren't they? Would that we all were. Hope that you are. Know that many of you are. Let's get serious about this. They learned the lesson. Okay, we're going to be studying that in some detail when we get over to Ezekiel 18 here in quite a while. But I'm really glad that you brought it up. Brethren, is there a difference between being charged with someone else's sin so that you are guilty of their sin or held guilty for their sin? Is there a difference between that and suffering a punishment because they sinned, having adverse circumstances befall you because they sinned? There's a big difference between these two, and the Scripture is quite plain about it. You can never be charged with somebody else's sin, but you can suffer the consequences for somebody else's sin. Well, it was just the most awful thing today. I think it was in Texas, in New Mexico. I believe it was down in New Mexico. And it's just the most awful thing. A couple of people are up on a freeway. There's a father in a four-door pickup truck, nice big pickup. And in the back seat, he's got two little kids in the back seat. Mom's not there, dad and two kids driving down the freeway. There's another guy, apparently by himself in his car, and who knows what happened. They decided that they were mad at each other. So what do we call this? Road rage. So they decide for the next mile or two that they're going to be cutting each other off, you know, and making this show of just making life hard on the highway. I taught driver's ed. You don't know how many times I taught my kids not to do this. Okay, sure enough, the guy that doesn't have anybody in the car with him pulls up, pulls a gun, fires around, and kills a four-year-old girl in the backseat. What's that about? Pure, selfish, sinful stupidity. So who paid the price for Papa's sin? A little four-year-old girl died today in New Mexico because her dad didn't have self-control. Because her dad, you know, didn't have the ability to understand patience. Couldn't rein himself in, decided he was going to be vindictive, he was going to play this game with a total stranger, and he paid the price. And by the way, my favorite story I used to tell in driver's ed was about a guy I knew, a Christian, in Indiana, where I preached a meeting, told me about this, and he was out the country road one day, and the guy in front of him kept slowing down on purpose. He kept backing off, you know, and then the guy was trying to catch him. And finally, it was an accident. He succeeded. The Christian in the behind, you know, got too close, and he slammed on the brakes and tapped him just a little bit. Well, that scared him, and he didn't want to talk to this guy, and the guy was already acting crazy. So he made, you know, the mistake. He decided to pass this guy, and he succeeded. So that makes him mad. All right, next thing you know, this guy's now on my tail, kind of in control now. He's chasing this guy down the highway, you know, and then he succeeds in passing again. Your classic road rage deal going on. And then the guy who created the little bump up ahead now pulls a Huey and a gun and gets two rounds off, one of them going through this guy's shoulder. He has to drive himself to the hospital now. Okay? You never know. Okay? But you'll pay for other people's sins sometimes. In that, you suffer
as an innocent individual, brethren, is that wrong? You say, well, yeah, okay, now let me ask you this. Is it the way the world turns? Yeah, okay. So you learn to think ahead about the consequences of this sort of misbehavior. So at any rate, to answer your question, you know, nobody's being charged with somebody else's sin. We don't put four-year-olds in jail because dad deserves a ticket. You know, but the consequences of the sin can be horrific. Nobody was charged with Achan's sin, but they sure paid the price. So now, let's see this, though. If you rebel, go back to verse 18, if you rebel today against the Lord, you know, tomorrow he'll be angry with what? The whole congregation. Now, brethren, they got it. They were willing to declare war. They were serious. But it's that next sentence that really gets me, where they say, if the land of your possession is unclean, then cross over to the land of the possession of the Lord, where the Lord's tabernacle stands, take possession among us, but don't rebel. What did they just say? They just said, we'll give up major portions of our land. We'll just give it to you if you'll just not commit this sin. Now, brother, that's amazing. That's impressive. It's one thing to say, you sin, and I'm going to kill you. A lot of people, you know, get mad when they see a sin. But to say, you sinned, and I'll pay to prevent you from sinning, that's just a whole different level, isn't it? So, they wanted righteousness. They wanted communal righteousness. They wanted national righteousness. And they would pay for it in war if they had to. But they would give up vast reaches of their own land to prevent it as well. So, brethren, learn the lesson. And be proactive, you know, and positive about trying to prevent sin. This is one of the great lessons, I think, not just of this book, but of the entire Bible. Chapter 23 is entitled Joshua's Farewell Address. Joshua realizes, if you turn the page to the first lines on page 254, he says, I am old, advanced in age. You've seen all the Lord your God has done to all these nations because of you. The Lord your God is he who fought for you. He recognizes that he's not long for this earth. So in the right-hand column on 254, in chapter 23 at verse 14, behold, this day I am going the way of all the earth. And you know, in all your hearts and in all your souls, that not one thing has failed of all the good things which the Lord your God spoke concerning you. All have come to pass for you. Not one word of them has failed. Therefore it shall come to pass that as all the good things have come upon you which the Lord your God promised you, so the Lord will bring upon you all harmful things until he has destroyed you from this good land which the Lord your God has given you when you have transgressed the covenant of the Lord your God, which he commanded you, and have gone and served other gods and bowed down to them, then the anger of the Lord will burn against you, and you shall perish quickly from the good land which he has given you. Like Moses before him, what is Joshua doing? Joshua present to hear Moses do it. Rehearse the history of these people, all the wonderful things God has done, and then warn them that God wants to give you good. But if you sin, if you rebel against him, you'll pay the price for it. I guess I did get to chapter 23, didn't I? Okay, which now brings us to chapter 24. We're going to talk a little bit about Shechem again here later in the class. But the renewal of a covenant takes place yet again. And Joshua, of course, in this most famous of his speeches, which we teach our kids from 3 years old, you know, and up, and make that famous declaration, as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. That, of course, has been in the mouths of Bible-believing people ever since. We're looking at well over 3,000 years now, and admiring and respecting an individual who, from a young age to a very advanced age, Joshua the son of Nun had always been what? Faithful to his God. When 10 out of 12 were being unfaithful,
He and Caleb were going to be faithful. No matter if all the crowd turned against God's plans, Joshua and Caleb would defend what was right. And they had seen in their lifetime then all of this wondrous, miraculous activity of their God. And so he challenges the people there at Shechem, which they went to in chapter 8 to recite the blessings and the curses with the tabernacle and the priests in the valley below, which is geographically just about dead center in their promised land. He brings them back here now that they've largely conquered that territory. He then says, you know, let's take that oath again. And they swear that they will. Now, I forgot something while I was coming through there. It just hit me. So everybody turn back, please, to page 246. 246. On the top of that page, you've got one of these uninspired historical observations. I hope you've got a pencil or a pen. But in that block there, where it speaks of Merenptah, the subduer of Gezer, in Joshua chapter 16, please write in that block at the top, there's room, as I've done, see also, so S-E-E also, the top of page 288. See also, top of page 288. And then, if you will, turn over to page 288, and in the exact same position, you have another one of these uninspired historical blocks that speaks of the Israel stele, or stela, I believe it's pronounced both ways, of Merenptah. Always had a problem, you know, with my Egyptian. Got to polish that. But, you know, a stela or a stele is, a stone monument that has writing on it, you know, and a very ancient record there. And I thought that the information on page 288, you know, was especially enlightening for the sake of page 246. Don't want to take the time to work with it here tonight, but if you have the note, we're going to be coming to it again later. You know, anytime you read, you know, about that stela on 246, make sure you read over on 288 as well. Okay, now, what's most of the book of Joshua about? You know, tribal lands. And so you say, well, you know, seven chapters to start with, and then others that are involved in it too, you know, and let's just not deal with it. You know, brother, no, that's a mistake too. And so we are going to deal with it tonight. I'm going to use now for the rest of the evening a long series of maps and photographs to try to help us appreciate what God did here. So while for us, you know, it's like reading somebody else's travel log, and you wouldn't think it's very interesting. For them, brethren, it was everything. It was their national land. It was their new and first homeland. By divine oracle and proclamation, they got this land. And then every one of these tribes had extremely detailed lot description. Everything, you know, but latitude and longitude that tells them exactly what the borders of their various tribal regions are. So if you want to spend, you know, half our class talking about this promised land, which for them at this time, brethren, it's worth their blood, it's worth their lives, it's worth killing off 2.5 tribes, it's worth giving up a whole lot of our land, maybe a third of our land, so they come live with us, because this is God's land, our land, and we need to be pure and holy and righteous within it. So to start with, I'm going to zoom in now on the bottom part of that map right there. Simeon's territorial region, as you read, is very unusual, but it's landlocked inside another tribal area. You don't ever see that with any other tribe. This, we are told, is because the tribal land for Judah was too big for them. They just didn't need that much. And so Simeon was given tribal land. It's only God's purposes, and I can't tell you why. He didn't tell us that they're completely surrounded
Bottom territory of Judah. However, the region generally, and I don't think I've used this term yet, but you saw it in the reading. Everything that is to the south down here, if you draw a line from the bottom of the Dead Sea or even above that, you know, and west south, is generally referred to by one term. What is that term? This is the Negev. N-E-G-E-V. Sometimes spelled with a B on the end. The Negev. The Negev rapidly gives way to extremely desolate desert. So it's not very attractive, you know, farther south. And for Judah's sake, you know, very few of those people are going to want to be living down in that region. It's just kind of inhospitable. So, Simeon lines up down here. Here's the border from Judah, you know, in green surrounding him. And you'll note that from the top of the Dead Sea, roughly, you know, there's a pretty straight line goes through there from east to west. You've got Dan and Benjamin that are on that line with Ephraim immediately above. And then continuing that line, but on the eastern side of, you know, which is the northern half of the Dead Sea, you have Reuben's territory, followed by Gad to the north, everybody on the east side of the Jordan, the two and a half tribe, because Manasseh's up above and also over on the left. But what we want to do is look at each of these tribal areas. So we're going to start with these six, Simeon, Judah, Dan, Benjamin, and Ephraim. And then we'll come back and Reuben, and we'll come back and look at the others. Simeon is living in the one-word term, the Negev. By the way, what does Negev mean? South. Exactly. That's all the word means. This is Beersheba, sometimes pronounced Beersheba, and the very famous expression we talk about in Scripture, if you're going to say from north to south, the length of the promised land, you use the expression from Dan to here. Okay? Now, in case you think, well, they got a wrong deal. Yeah. This is that city, what remains, you know, have come to light, and true is flat. Okay? But it's also still able to grow. And it's great country for sheep, for goats, for camels. You know, there's a variety of livestock that can be grown in this area. So Simeon, one of the smaller tribes, is down the furthest south, really, of everybody, and that's what it looks like. This is one of their major cities. Just to the north of them is Judah. The city of Lachish, standing on the tell, which is the ruins of the old city there, with the mound that's, you know, growing up over it. As you look out the surrounding territory, they're in the area of just wonderfully beautiful rolling hills. Here is an area where you can grow wine and a wide variety of other crops. Here is an area, you know, where, of course, your livestock are going to prosper as well. So Judah is the southernmost of the tribes, save for Simeon, and Judah envelops even part of the south. But, you know, immediately when you get into the major part of Judah and the northern part of Simeon, really beautiful, gloriously productive land. Reuben was on the east side of the Dead Sea and had about, you know, half, the northern half of the Dead Sea, you know, territory to the east. Obviously an aerial photograph, but again, surprisingly, we think of it as being desolate ways. Now you can see that you can farm in that territory, and again, wonderfully good for the various kinds of livestock that might be growing up in that region. Dan, now what was the expression? Dan Beersheba, okay. Well, where would you think Dan would be? In the far north. But it's not. He's in the southern half. What did you learn about that in your reading? Why is there a city named Dan way up in the north while the tribal area is way down in the south? What happened?
They went hiding.
Yeah. They decided that they wanted to have a cabin in the woods. They wanted to have a summer place. Okay. I don't know exactly what the reason was, but they decided, well, you know, we're going to go out and, you know, on a military foray here, and we're going to take some territory farther to the north. That, by the way, that they took is arguably the most beautiful place in all of Israel. So they went up outside another tribe's area, you know, and grabbed that particular city. but the tribal area, not in the north. This is the city of Ajalon, and again, really pretty. The weather is like Southern California, most of Israel, you know, Dead Sea is another matter, but much of Israel is just like being in San Diego year-round. It's got fields, the vegetation's the same way. Here is Benjamin, which is immediately adjacent to Jerusalem, the city of Gibeon here, and you can tell now we're more up in the mountainous part of Israel. Now, these mountains are not very big. They're just like what we call Cobra Hills, but that's, you know, what you have in Israel, and again, highly, wonderfully, beautifully productive land. Ephraim also had a tribal area here in Shiloh that looks very desolate. And again, at first, you know, it's just one area, one little canyon. So much of what we would think of is better than this. But I want you to notice something here. Do you see, brethren, all these terraces? You see out the striations in the hillside there? Okay. Do you think that's natural? To some extent, it is. But throughout Israel, a number of times I'd stop and I'd look, you know, and we'd park the car and I'd just go look, and you'd realize that what this is grazing animals going back and forth and establishing their little trail and then coming up to the next level and just grazing back and forth. It's very good countryside for the livestock, for the goats and for the sheep. Well, not too many of us into that, although I know there's a lot of sheep in this area. How many of you are sheep ranchers? Okay. But over there, it's ideal countryside for that. So there's Ephraim in Shiloh. Now, back to our original map. Let's go up to the northern tribes. I'm going to overlap here. I'm going to zoom into the bordered area, but you know those tribes through the center there, you'll be seeing again on the next map. We've already talked about those, but you know, here they are in the back. We just talked about Ephraim and Shiloh. Okay, so here's Manasseh on the west. Here's Manasseh on the east. And between the two of them, who's got the most land? What's the biggest tribe? Same one. Manasseh was huge. Very prolific people. And so they got a split tribe. You keep reading about the half tribe of Manasseh. Well, it's half over here and half over there. And then, between them, you've got Gad, who has this kind of horseshoe shape, you know, like this, that runs up on both sides of East Manasseh, his territory being over here on the east of the Jordan as well. Okay, and then, here's Issachar, Zebulun, Asher in green, and Naphtali between the sea and what are the Golan Heights. Okay, so, give you again an idea of what all this looks like. As I was preparing this lesson, I was thinking, where would I want to live if I could pick what tribe in the old days, you know, I want to be a part of? If I want to own land in Israel, where would I want to live? Brethren, it would be really hard to pick. Immediately, just my mind is just filled with scenes that are so beautiful that, you know, I think I live here, I live there, I live the other. This is Caesarea Maritima. This is one of the places where Herod the Great decided he was going to live. And that's where his winter palace was. His summer palace, we talked about last week, was where? Jericho. So, Herod had two big palaces. He had a third one in Jerusalem, as a matter of fact. But, you know, here, in Caesarea Maritima, built the artificial harbor. You know, it's just amazingly beautiful seaport town now. So there's Caesarea Maritima. West Manasseh inherited that coastline along there. Gad, more in the center. This is the area of Jabesh-Gilead, and that doesn't do it justice. It's probably summer when the picture was taken. The hills would go much more green at a different time of year. Asher, his territory was also on the coast. This is the modern city of Haifa up on Mount Carmel. You can then look out over the whole bay. It's the one really serious big bay, you know, naturally, that they have in all of Israel. And the countryside, again, is kind of just grayed off as you look at the photo there. But when Cheryl and I flew over this region, it just takes your breath away. It's just absolutely astonishingly beautiful. And then
Nazareth was in the territory of Zebulun. Here's another one of those places where it'd be real easy to say, well, that's where I want to live.
Nazareth is up on a hillside. It has just sweeping vistas of the Jezreel Valley. The Jezreel Valley is marked with hills, you know, in the distance as well. It's just a marvelously beautiful place to live.
So this is Zebulun, and, of course, larger than just the one city, significantly. The countryside of Issachar has another city sound like the other one, Beersheba, but this is Beth Shean.
And again, some of the largest Roman ruins in all of Israel are found here. When you climb up, which I wasn't able to do, our guide told us you either pick. You're going to do the Roman ruins from the time of Christ, or you can climb up this hill and see the overview. So I opted to stay with the guide. I figured he was a source of more information. And otherwise, I'd just be looking at the view and wouldn't know what I was seeing. So I stayed with him, and we toured all through these ruins and a great deal more than what you can see here. But if you do go up on the top, the views from up there, once again, you just say, this is it. This is where I am. One olive over there. One olive over there.
So, brethren, it was a land flowing with milk and honey. It was God's promised land, and it didn't matter what area you found yourself in. You'd be happy. You'd be glad with the tribal area that you had been given.
This, of course, is the north shore of the Sea of Galilee, what is called the Plain of Gennesaret, and it is the place where Jesus spent the vast majority of his preaching time. So the Sermon on the Mount, all those kinds of things took place. Actually, the mountain would be right out of sight over here. But this is the region where Jesus spent, I don't know, two-thirds, three-quarters of the time while he was preaching here on this earth. The city of Tiberias is this area right in here, a pretty good-sized city.
And then we have East Manasseh, which you hear the term every day.
Now, it encompasses all of the area that today we call the Golan Heights. That's the Sea of Galilee in the distance right there. And as the name suggests today, you have the highest areas in Israel, and modern Israel no longer has the real high reaches of Mount Hermon. And so this is approaching those foothills. And once again, the vistas and the view and all that is just amazing and wonderfully productive land.
Okay, there's our map. Here is what it looks like today. Now, brethren, we could stop the class and say, well, okay, you know, that's more than I wanted to know anyway about these tribal areas. But what was everything for a Jew 3,000 years ago?
The promised land. Okay? Now, the people who call themselves Jews today are not, by biblical definition, there's political designations, you know, they call themselves Jews, they're referred to by other nations as Jews, but biblically they no longer meet the biblical definition at all. So, nonetheless, a people who call themselves Jews, who think but cannot prove that they are descendants of Abraham, are now living in the same area. I did the best I could to get these two maps, to line up. So density, try to get pretty much the same size right there. Now, today, we have the same thing going on, brethren, that was going on 3,200 plus years ago. Is it a country that is at peace and at rest? No. In Joshua's day, was it a country that was at peace and at rest? Not while it was living. And then for a while they had it, before they immediately turned to what? Sin and rebellion, just like it had been prophesied by Moses and Joshua. And then what happens? There's trouble everywhere. God allows all these other people to rise up and fight, and the land's been, you know, just awash in blood ever since. But most of us, because it is so confusing and tangled, really have a problem understanding what's going on in Israel today. So I thought it'd be worth a few minutes at least, you know, to understand first why people fight over this country. Why? We just saw 13 representative pictures. Didn't begin to do it justice. Why did he fight over it? Because it's great. It's really great. And so people want it. Okay? Now, the three areas that you hear the most about, there's four actually, but the three you hear about in the news are the Golan Heights, the West Bank, and the Gaza Strip. Raise your hand if you think you know anything about their history. A little bit from one person. Okay. How much money do we send to Israel? Incalculable. Okay? A lot of it winds up over there because they're dealing with the Gaza Strip right here. More on that in just a second. It is just a strip of land, tiny little thing. Please note, Gaza Strip is named after the big city, which is Gaza. Ashkelon, which is just outside that border, and Ashdod. And then, they're not on this map, but Ekron and Gath are the five cities of whom?
The Philistines.
That's where the Philistines were. And those Philistines are still fighting for that land. And where did the word Palestine come from? Philistia. That's where it originates. So these people in that territory only had five major cities, but they were tough stuff. Okay? And that region is still fighting against nominal Jews now, though not biblical Jews, to this day. So a tiny little trick down there. What's this word here? Negev. It means south. See on all the maps. Okay, here's a dotted line. It starts in the middle of the Dead Sea from north to south, in the middle of the Dead Sea, east and west. Okay, and following that line right through here, this is the area that they call, just in violently here to get half of Jerusalem, and it comes back down like this, and this area is called the West Bank. Okay? Because that's where you go to get your checks cashed, right? West Bank. Why is it called the West Bank? Because it's on the west side of what bank? The Jordan River's banks. That's the West Bank. Okay? And then up to the north, here's another kind of a dotted line right here. Starts off solid because it's a hard line with Syria. Comes over like this and then comes down like that. These are the, this is as big as my hand, the Golan Heights. Okay, now very rapidly, because I know you don't need to remember this, but it is the background for our own time as people continue to fight over this land. The British took over control here, what they call the British Mandate, in 1920. After World War II, on November 29th of 1947, the United Nations Partition Plan for Palestine, that's the official title, established that the West Bank was going to be given to Palestinians. Israel was going to surround it. Okay? That's where the West Bank came from. 11/29/48. Then, 47 rather, just 6 months later, on May 15th, Egypt, to the south, Jordan, everything on the east side except in the north, Syria, also Jordan, Syria, there's a line between those two, they got in cahoots with some help from Iraq, and they invaded Palestine. The war was fought only 6 months after Israel was given their land with the UN partition. These countries invaded. 10 months later, Israel had still control of everything the UN had designated as a state of Israel, a nation for the Jews. And they had 60% of the land that had been given to the Palestinians. They were very successful in their battles there. But the upheaval, brethren, was immense. 700,000 Arabs fled the area, never to return. And 700,000 Jews poured in from all over the world in the next 3 years. That entire country just churned. Okay? It was
huge in world history, and we're watching the repercussions to this day. Then
the West Bank was captured by Jordan. Okay?
So now Jordan takes it back, but in 1967,
they're still controlling this region,
and another war erupts called the Six-Day War. In the Six-Day War, Israel saw it coming, and they weren't going to let this happen again. They got surprised in 1948, not twice. So when they saw troops massing on the border this time, they fired up all their jets, took to the air, and flew down to the air bases in Egypt, and they wiped out almost every plane the Egyptians had in a, you know, first strike. Wow. And then things went better from that. They destroyed nearly the entire Egyptian Air Force. They took the entire Sinai Peninsula for themselves. They got the West Bank and the Golan Heights. Okay? So now they had everything. Okay? But the Golan Heights
then were lost to Syria, and we've been fighting over that, or they've been fighting over that
ever since. Now then, this is Israel today turned sideways.
After all of this unhappiness, Jordan played a major role, and they had the West Bank, and they had the Golan Heights, and then a war break out, and they would lose it, you know, and the UN was all involved, and then Gaza Strip, you know, all this stuff has left four main areas in Israel. The Gaza Strip, the West Bank, the Golan Heights, and what is Israel proper, as they call it, which means Israel is surrounded by what? Enemies, as they always have been. Okay? But I wanted you to see this map because it does a good job of showing the terrain. In the Negev, it's mostly desert. They had all the Sinai. They decided to give it up for the sake of peace, so they gave it back to Egypt. Okay? And then as you head north, it starts from the green. The hills go up like this. You got the Jordan River, the lowest place on earth, all the way up, getting taller and taller as you go north until you get clear to the Golan Heights and eventually Mount Hermon at 9,000 feet. From space, brethren, it looks like this. God decided that for 3,000 years to get to us, but for a space of time of about 1,300 or 1,400 years, Israel is going to be the center of his old covenant. They're going to be interacting with Egypt. There's your Nile Delta. They're going to be fighting with everybody everywhere around them. They came through the Sinai Peninsula to come over here alongside the Dead Sea
and occupy this easy, teensy, tiny little area that today we call Israel.
As you zoom in, Ben, on this particular map, here's the Gulf of Aqaba, okay, Sinai Peninsula, Negev, the south of Israel, and they actually have everything down, you know, in a pyramid down right to here. Okay, now you can see the Sea of Galilee showing up.
In the next photograph, as we zoom in again, Mount Hermon is over 9,000 feet high.
So there's a lot of snow in this particular satellite photo here. And now you can see the borderline coming down the Gulf of Aqaba. That's the political boundary today. You begin to see the Gaza Strip right there. Golan Heights is this area right here.
So these four regions still fighting to this day. Now hopefully you can see the borders again a little bit better.
Gaza Strip in red. West Bank, also in red. Jordan bordering Syria. Everybody fighting for the Golan Heights, particularly because this close and this high, it's the best place to kill people. You want to start lobbing stuff down to try and destroy somebody, you want the high country, you want the Golan Heights.
So Israel is controlling that area right now, but of course it's just, you know, constantly fought over. Now, the biggest problem they have is the Gaza Strip. Did you know that thing from top to bottom, farthest reach, is only 29 miles? That's all it is. And it's only 3.5 miles wide at that narrow point right there. which means it's got 139 square miles. And in 139 square miles, there are 2,600,000 people. Now, very carefully, I spent some time, and I mapped out what would be about 139 square miles for us. So, you're, you know, Irving and Pleasant Hill, Coburg in the center up the top right there, didn't quite get all of Springfield in, you know, great majority of Eugene right there. So that's the same size as Gaza Strip. One difference, you'd have to multiply our population by 6.5 times. And you'd have to take away all the forests in almost every place that you could grow anything. And then, turning to the sea for their livelihood, Israel has said, you can't go more than 3 miles offshore. So all your fishing boats have to stay within 3 miles. There are 2.6 million people, brethren, that are starving over there. So, what are they doing? Like anybody, when they're trapped and dying, suffering, you know, they're wanting out. They want their oppressors, as they view it, and there's some good reason to call them that, you know, to be defeated. Now, I just want to say one thing, you know, about all that goes on today in the Middle East. Remember the old history. And it'll start coming alive for you every time you hear about the same cities in Israel that we're going to be reading about generation after generation as we go by. These cities, these places are still there. And remember this, there's two sides to every story. And in America, we only hear one. And it's amazing, having been over there now, what a shock it is to go over there and see what really goes on. You can't go to Israel without coming back much more favorably, you know, feelings toward the Palestinians. They are being mistreated much of the time. There's plenty enough guilt and blame to go around for everybody. Here's my last map for tonight. And again, I like turning these like this. From the lowest point on earth, with hills and mountains on both sides, farmland scattered through it all, and well-watered, with some places that are also visually just stunning. You have the land flowing with milk and honey, in which God would develop His Old Testament people, His Old Covenant sacrificial system, and all of it for the coming of His Son to save the Jews, to save the world. Today, that land, God has not designated as belonging to anybody. The old covenant is over. By the biblical definition, there's no such thing as a Jew. So who's right and who's wrong today? Everybody. Okay? Now I'll leave you with this. This upcoming week, get ready and, you know, plan ahead. This is a 19er. It's got 19 pages of reading. That is the first time. There'll be two more where you have to read 19 pages in a week. You'll have 1 week where you have 20 pages, 1 week at 21, and one at 22. But this is your introduction this week, you know, to the big ones. These are not consecutive. But three times there'll be 19 pages to be reading. So get ready this week. You know, you're going to have to spend extra time. There's a lot more work that needs to be done. We're starting the period of the judges. Comment or question? Bill?
Parting thought, back to Shechem. Shechem was the time that
It's where the promise was given in Genesis 12. Okay, Carol?
Just one thing, you were equating the four-year-old's death action to be, we would say it was wrong. But you sort of equated it to the fact that Achan and his family, God can't be wrong in what he did. So although we want to feel
Exactly. Brethren, left to our own devices, how many different moral systems would we have? As many as there are people. Who alone can determine morality? The Creator God, who gave us existence.
Whenever you think something you see God, you know, doing is incorrect or is somehow, you know, just unfair, recognize it's our value system that needs the training, not his.